Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'll be your host this afternoon. It is my great pleasure to host another radio program about the mob. I have to admit that before I became acquainted with author and crime writer Denny Griffin, my knowledge of the mob was just about zero. It was based solely on Hollywood's portrayal of it, which, as it turns out, is not particularly accurate. Several weeks ago, I was introduced to an ex-Gambino crime member, Andrew DiDonato. Last week, I was introduced to a gentleman that I only know as Joe. He was also an ex-mob member, and one who, for personal security reasons, prefers not to reveal his real name. And I'll be honest with you, I don't blame him. I find that the more I talk to people like Denny, Andrew, and Joe, the more questions I have. So what I want to do today is ask some of those questions. And to help me answer them, I'm delighted to tell you that we have author and crime writer Denny Griffin on the line. Denny, it's always good to talk to you.
My pleasure to be with you again, Simon. Thank you.
And I am sorry about your microwave.
Thank you.
Denny's microwave is broken, and Denny is a coffee-holic, and he has no way to heat his coffee up. So he's probably going to be fairly cranky this afternoon. Also joining us is Andrew DiDonato. Andrew, it is always great to talk to you.
For me as well, Simon. Thank you very much for having me.
And I do hope that you're going to be having a splendid Memorial weekend.
Oh, I'm going to make the best of it. Don't you worry. We'll make the best of it, that's for sure.
That's good. Our phone lines are open, and if any listeners want to call in with any questions or comments, you're more than welcome to. The dial-in number is area code 646-378-1120. Okay, on with the program. But Andrew, you and I have talked on numerous occasions, and you know, I hate to show my ignorance, but I honestly do not understand the organization of a crime family. You throw terms out like capos and captains and bosses and underbosses and crews. Can you break it down for me? Can you make it into English?
I could break it down for you. It's very easy once you start to get the hang of it, Simon. What it is, you know, the traditional organized crime family structure was based upon levels within the organization to protect the people on the top. So you have your street soldier who, you know, you're basically your maid members of the family who they hold a rank in the family. They're not bottom of the totem pole, but they're what you might call your grunt workers. Underneath them, they have associates. Each one of them has their own crews, so to speak. And their crews are responsible to whatever area that they're living in to conjure up some money, schemes, robberies, whatever they can do to control their area. They, in turn, take it to their crew leader, who, in turn, kicks up the percentage to a captain. Now, years ago, they used to have a term called capo tagine. Capo tagine is when, used to be, in Italian, it's called captain of 10. It's not like that anymore. Now you have a captain who might have five maid members underneath him to control, and each one of them has their own crew. So what he does is each one of them kick up to this particular captain, who in turn takes his percentage out and kicks the rest up to the underboss and to the boss of the family. And that's how the structure works.
Okay. Before you go any further, What can you define what a maid man is?
Well, the main man is somebody who was formally inducted into the crime family. What I mean by that is somebody who went through the ceremony procedures where he became what they call in this life a friend of ours. If you're a made member of the family, you become what they call a friend of ours. In other words, it's just everybody, how can I explain it on layman's terms? All it is now you're formally inducted. You're recognized throughout the organized crime, throughout the other families. They recognize you as a member of the family. I myself, I wasn't a made member of the family. I was what you might call a mob associate. For political reasons or whatever it may be, I never got to that level because of, you know, I was in trouble with the law. I was on the run for a long time. I was at odds with the boss of our family, etc. There's many things to go. And it's a very political life. You know, it's very political, what people don't understand. But at the end of the day, it just shows that you are recognized by other crime families as a member of that family. So in other words, you're able to speak to members from other families directly, and they will have conversation with you about organized crime activity. A person such as myself, an associate, by the way, the rules of this life, you're not privy to go to speak to a person from another crime family who's inducted in their family one-on-one. You need a representative to have those conversations, which in turn, Simon, to be realistic, it's all bullshit anyway, because I was associated for many of years, and I used to speak to captains and bosses from other families because I was in the street for so long that they knew where my flag was. They knew that I was with Nicholas Carrazzo. They knew that I was trusted within our family, and I used to speak to these guys on a general basis. Everybody's situation is different. For other guys, it might not have been so. But for me, I didn't have that crutch, so to speak. I was able to go throughout the five families and speak to who I needed to when the time came, and that was that.
Okay, now the American mob, the American mafia, if you will, is pretty closely follows the Italian version, the Cosa Nostra, is it?
Yeah, the Cosa Nostra. And the way it was perceived was, you know, back in the day when Lucky Luciano, when all those guys took over after all the, what we call them, mustache peace, or, you know, without giving a derogatory term, we would call them, you know, guys from the other side. You know, after they took over from them, what they did was they held the structure that there wouldn't be one particular boss who ran everything. There would be a committee, so to speak, five different families who basically get together for big meetings that have to deal with situations that pertain to organized crime within the New York area. You know, within the construction industry, gambling, or whatever scenarios deemed important mob business, there would be a committee that, based on these decisions, and they would cut up the piece of the pie accordingly throughout the five families. And the structure worked perfectly.
Denny, you're based in Las Vegas for part of the year, and your book on Frank Collada actually covers the Chicago connection to Las Vegas, and in fact, your other book, the Battle for Las Vegas, I think it's called.
Yeah.
Did the Chicago families communicate with the New York family?
Yes, there was interaction, and you take the Las Vegas piece of the thing. Vegas was considered by the mob, or mobs, if you will, to be an open city. And anybody, any family from anywhere in the country could come into Las Vegas and dip their hand in the pie, or what was the line out of the Godfather 2, wet their beak with that Vegas money. So these various families did have relationships and communication and so forth, and they all got their piece of the action in Vegas. And they were businessmen, these people. And in order to maximize their earnings, there were certain cases where it was in their best interest to work together. And as long as they recognized whose who was in which casino, who was doing which skim, and so on and so forth, and didn't interfere, but worked jointly on some occasions, or at least left the other guy's operations alone. Everything worked fine. No, these people knew each other. They knew who was who, and they did communicate, and they did on occasion have joint or cooperative efforts.
Okay, Andrew, you've mentioned the term crew many times, and I realize now that a crime family wouldn't have one crew; they would have potentially many crews. But what defines a crew, like in terms of numbers? And did crews have specific tasks, like, you know, robbing banks, gambling, extortion?
Well, what happens is this. It's every main member of the family has his own crew. And his own crew, their job is, a crew leader is only as strong as his team, and his team is his crew. So everybody's crew has different assets. You know, within our crew, we had a very, very big gambling operation. We had a very big auto theft ring within our crew. We were very big in the extortion arena. We extorted many drug dealers and local guys who were doing criminal activity who weren't involved with organized crime. There's so many different aspects because each crew, you know, it's all the luck of the draw, Simon. I mean, you could be a crew leader and I'm underneath you, and I just might be this big Wall Street guy who was very good at white-collar, you know, schemes, and I was able to conjure up million-dollar schemes to put a lot of money in your pocket. And that might, you know, that might make you look good to your superiors. And each crew was run differently. It's all, like I said, it's all going to according to the luck of the draw. Some crew leaders are a lot more greedy than others. Others are a little bit more bloodthirsty than others. And because you're dealing with people with personalities, of course. So it's like anything else. You work for this big corporation, and the guy who your immediate supervisor may be, he may be a great guy. Other guys, say from the Bronx faction of the Gambino family, might be underneath a crew leader who is, say, not such a nice guy. He's greedy. He's selfish. He gives his guys, he takes a bigger percentage of the guys' cuts when they, you know, go out and do robberies, so to speak, or things like that. And, you know, basically some guys, you know, like myself, when I was younger, I thought my crew leader walked on water. I thought this guy was the best thing in the world. You know, I didn't get snake bit till many years later, realizing that, you know, he was a very selfish individual, and, you know, que sera, sera, that's what happened. But you can't change that. There's nothing you can do about that. You know, you can try. I mean, go ahead.
Well, one of the things that you brought up, I think it might have been on the on our last program, or certainly in on one of the programs that we've had, is lost my train of thought here.
Take your time. We're open all day.
Okay. The big bosses.
Yes.
Don't really like publicity.
No, of course not. This is supposed to be a secret society, Simon.
Right. Yeah. It's like the Masons.
Yeah. Well, Masons with a very sharper edge.
Right. No. My point is, they don't like publicity, and if I was to put myself in their shoes, I would be very concerned that I wanted to be kept in the loop of everything that's going on, you know, so that if a crew was, you know, going rogue, shall we say, getting involved in something that they shouldn't be involved in, you know, you can stop it.
That's understandable, and yes, and that's the mindset. That is the mindset. But like anything else, when you're in the street and you're doing things, you know, sometimes guys and crews are making big money, and they don't want their superiors to know how much they're making, because they know that when you're making huge money, usually the guys who are in the superior positions are going to try to take from that. So there's a good chance that if you're making too much money, they're going to try to really control what you're doing. So guys in my position, yes, we pass the buck up, sure, because we know if you're part of an organization like this, you have to kick in. If you're earning, you have to kick in. But there are many times where I hid my earnings. I really did. I hid what I was making so that they wouldn't take too much of what I was doing. That happens a lot. But they, yes, in the boss's position, knowing what the guys underneath you are doing is very important. It's very important to be in the know. It really is, for many reasons, for law enforcement aspect reasons, for earning reasons, and let's face it, in this world, information is power, period.
What concerns me is the recent events concerning the Gambino family. It seems to me that running a underage prostitution ring on Craigslist is definitely not something that a boss would want. You know.
100% right. I agree with you 100%.
Does this mean that today's management isn't as knowledgeable as yesterday's management was?
I believe in a strong sense, yes. There are still some old timers out there, guys who are back on the street who just finished up incarceration and stuff of that nature. But for the most part, the American organized crime as we know it has been decimated in numbers due to heavy law enforcement indictments and arrests throughout the years. Law enforcement, the FBI, and local law enforcement have declared war on organized crime for the last 15 to 20 years now. And it's kept organized crime on the ropes, so to speak, where they haven't been able to plant their feet to really, get things back on track the way that they used to have it. Even when I was in the street in the late 90s, we stopped having social clubs. We used to meet 2-3 o'clock in the morning, in diners and jumping in each other's cars and being very, very secretive to the point where it was almost impossible to operate under these circumstances because law enforcement had put such a strain. And I think now that has weakened the leadership capacities, because if you're the boss today, within a month from now, the FBI is banging on your door and you're under arrest. They are then it's no-nonsense policy these days. And what happens is you got guys now in positions who don't belong there. They're not qualified to be in these positions, but they're all that's left out there. So now these guys are making these decisions that they're really not ready to make, and they're just trying to stay afloat, and they're open to any and all activities that could bring in money. And when they do so, they're pretty much making bad business decisions. And something like this with this underage prostitution ring is definitely one of them, because whether they're going to admit it or not, somebody in a high-ranking position knew this was going on at some point. Now, did they turn a blind eye to it just as long as the money came in? I would assume yes. Are heads going to roll? I don't know what's going to happen as far as that's concerned, but in the perfect organized crime, Gambino crime family setting that I grew up around, yes, somebody's going to be held responsible for that down the line. Whether they wait for that, go ahead.
Denny, what did you think of this latest series of arrests and the underage prostitution? I mean, to me, sure, organized crime has been involved with prostitution in the past, albeit I don't think it was a major, piece of the action. Were you as shocked as I was?
Yes, I was. I was quite surprised to hear that, and as has been discussed here, that would not be the type of thing I would think from a PR standpoint that you'd want out there, in the media, that you've been charged with this type of activity. So yes, I was very surprised, and as Andrew says, did somebody know about it? Well, probably, and as he mentioned, as long as the money was coming in, there was no doubt a blind eye turned. But now that it's hit, that has to be an embarrassment, and maybe, like Andrew says, maybe things are different today, and maybe nobody will be held accountable. But I don't know. If I was in the loop there and had knowledge of this and condoned it or gave tacit approval to it, and then had this stuff hit the papers, I wouldn't be resting very easily. I'd be afraid that somebody would come knocking. I might not the law, but one of my colleagues might have a little bone to pick with me.
Andrew, when you first brought up the this latest series of arrests, you made mention of the fact that you knew one of the gentlemen, and you were you weren't happy that he was indicted, but you did mention the fact that you were happy that his particular indictment did not include this child prostitution deal.
Yes, I said that because this gentleman, believe it or not, Simon, you know, you grow up in this life the way I did. You know, I was around this life, you know, from a very young age, from the age of 16 up, and you grow up and you're in this life, and there's particular people in the superior positions who you hear through the grapevine, or your superiors have business dealings with them or whatever, and you see how they treat this individual. And this person who we're speaking about was somebody who guys within my crew looked up to with great respect. This was somebody who was an old-school gangster who carried himself very well. He was a big money earner, and he had a good reputation for being that. I got to meet his family over the years, and I knew him to be a good family man as far as that was concerned. And when I heard about the indictment, and his name was on the top of the indictment because he's one of the highest ranking guys in the family that was in the street at this time, I was really taken back from this. And I would assume that he did not have any knowledge. It came out a few weeks after the arrest that he was not going to be implicated in that crime whatsoever, but he is a big money man. And knowing this, I am sure, like you said, this stops all money-making avenues, because this type of law enforcement pressure, it really, really puts a wedge in your other, you know, money-making operations. And I'm sure he's not a happy camper right now. And I'm sure right now he's saying to himself, these motherfuckers, excuse my language, but he must be saying, Jesus Christ, they put me in the pot here, and this is somebody who does not want to be in the public eye. This is somebody who wants to be, how can I say, with his head in the sand. And this brought him right out in the light here, and I'm sure he's very unhappy about that.
I'm no expert on organized crime, certainly not up to the standards of you and Denny, but I do spend some time, you know, poking around, I've come to the conclusion that you know, families sometimes have fallings out. Do the crews of a family generally get along together?
Well, what happens is like anything else, Simon. I mean, you know, organized crime circles, it's a very, very small community. You know, there's hundreds of guys, but it's a very small community. And, you know, there's guys that were in the same family as me who were from other factions, whether it be from Queens or from the Bronx or from Manhattan or Staten Island, whatever the case may be. And, of course, like anything else, you're not going to get along with everybody. But at the end of the day, you have to respect that person because you're all part of the same machine. And, you know, you could sit down and do business with this person and you could motherfucker him the whole day doing business with him, but at the end of the day, you have to show him respect. And that's what happens, and it has to be mutual respect. Because there's one thing the superiors don't like to see, and that's guys within the same family not being able to get along because other families see that, and it shows dissension, and they don't like that. And go ahead, sir.
Well, I was reading some things about, I believe it was the Colombo family, and
yes,
that there seemed to be a bit of a falling out between a couple of factions of them. Was that at the crew level, or was that at a much higher level?
Well, it started at a much higher level. What happened was the boss of the Colombo family in the mid-'80s, his name was Carmine Persico. Carmine Persico was a legend in organized crime circles. This guy was a gangster's gangster. And what had happened was Carmine Persico got arrested and indicted and, of course, later convicted in 1984-85 on what they called the commission case. He was sentenced to, I believe, 139 years, and all his appeals were exhausted, and he was going to spend the rest of his life in prison. And what had happened was, in his absence, he had put a person in charge by the name of Vicarina. Now, Vicarina was running the day-to-day operations of the Colombo crime family back then. And due by a lot of influence of our crime family, the Gambino crime family, we pretty much fueled the fire a little bit for the Colombo crime family war. Back then, a lot of guys were whispering in Vic's ears, this guy's never coming home. Your acting boss, just take it over. This guy's never coming back. You deserve it. You've been doing your work every day, and you're handling the situation day to day anyway. Might as well just become official boss. Other families like to see that because it shows stability within organized crime circles. The Gambino crime family, our crime family, was pretty much behind the Vicarina faction taking over because our family and within our faction, even my crew, had did a lot of work with Vicarina, Wild Bill Cotolo, and what they called the renegade faction of the Colombo family, the faction that tried to take it over from the Carmine Persico faction. And what happened was Vicarina and John Gotti Sr. had a pretty good relationship. And I think that, you know, for our family, it was a win-win had they been able to take over the crime family. Well, the war pursued because Carmine Persico had his loyalist of people who didn't want to turn the family over to Vic. Carmine had a son named Alley Boy Persico, who was in jail at the time, who was due to be getting released. And he wanted his son to take over the family. And the reason why they want this, like this, Simon, is because there's a lot of money at the top of the ladder. And giving up the mantle as boss, you're giving up that earned. And when you control it for so long, like anything else, you don't want to let it go. So a war ensued between the Vicarina loyalist and the Persico loyalist. And the war went on for many years. And at the end of the day, the Persico faction wind up winning the war. And that's what happened. And then what happened, there was a lot of repercussions from it. There was a lot of guys who were killed from it. A lot of politics. And in the end, nobody went because law enforcement arrests guys for committing crimes against their own. And the war destroyed a lot of guys. I was incarcerated with a lot of guys who got very big sentences from the, you know, what we call war crimes. You know, and these guys were doing 20, 30 years for, you know, conspiracy to murder, committing murder, a whole bunch of stuff, and all fighting amongst each other. And that deteriorated the Colombo family even to the point where it is today, because they still, after so many years, they still got both sides, you know, guys who thought this side should take it over or that side. So it'll never be the same.
I know last week when we were discussing the you know, how to rob a bank 101. You made the quip about, I believe we were talking about the, you know, size of your crew that was going to be involved in the heist, you know, and
yes, sir.
How difficult it is to keep secrets. And I believe you said something along the lines of, if you've got three people and you kill two of them, you'll be fine.
Yeah, well, basically, that's an old, how can I say it, an old adjective, or whatever you want to call it, for lack of a better word, you know, and what happens is like anything else, you know, but every different bank robbery or every different score, you know, may constitute more guys on board, you know, because some are more dangerous than others, some are more risky than others, you know, if you're going to rob, you know, money coming off a Brinks truck, you might want to have two or three guys up front, crash guy, a guy on a scanner, a guy waiting at another location for the getaway. So you might have five guys on the scene, you know, and these things can't be helped. Sometimes you could do it with a smaller crew where if you're going to do a bank burglary, you could do it. One guy is the lookout, the other guy goes and, you know, takes the box off the wall, and so to speak, and you could do it with a less crew. So every scenario is a little bit different. But at the end of the day, you have to have total trust within one another because you hold these crimes over each other's heads. And that's where the problem lies. That's where the problem lies because what happens is sometimes you get guys who they're a little too itchy when they see other guys getting problems or law enforcement problems, and right away they start to count the crimes they did with this person, and right away they're looking to target that person for murder, even though that person is not hurting them by becoming a witness or anything like that. But it's another saying they used to say, it's always safer to send flowers. And in mob circles, that's terrible because here you are, maybe you grew up with this guy, and you know this guy 30 years, but the other two guys you committed the bank robbery with don't know this guy for 30 years. And, you know, they don't look at him the same way you do. That's why it's a brutal life, because today we're friends, and tomorrow something may put us at odds, the politics, so to speak, of the life in itself. And it could be devastating, because if me and you were friends for 30 years, Simon, I'll be honest with you, I'm not all right taking your life. And sometimes it's something that happens, and you have to detach yourself from it. And it's a sad thing to speak, and it's a cold way to speak, but this is how these guys survive. They detach themselves from the emotional side of it.
Denny, you spent a good deal of time talking with Frank Collada, putting his biography together. He was a member of the infamous Hole in the Wall gang. Just out of curiosity, what was the average size team he would use to pull a burglary?
And Simon, after I answer this question, there's two other points I need to make. I think that's
okay.
Important. So the Hole in the Wall gang, which was actually a name assigned through the news media, range in size depending on the score. I think, as Andrew was mentioning, there are certain major scores require normally more people. You need more people involved. The biggest score that the Hole in the Wall gang did not commit but attempted was estimated to be a million dollar heist of a store in Las Vegas that had a jewelry component. Was a high-end store, and they had a lot of jewelry and so forth. And for that particular caper, they had six people. That would have been about the max that Frank ever used in any particular job. And this was a big one, and they needed the workers to actually go in the building. They needed a street crew to do counter surveillance, to check for police or FBI activity. In Frank's case, unfortunately, at the last moment, a seventh person was added to the crew. It turned out, as Frank suspected, this guy was an FBI informant, and that brought the whole crew crashing down. But to answer your question, the size varied. Some guys worked alone. Some guys would go out and do a job, a burglary or a robbery themselves. Sometimes two of them would go, sometimes three. The max that Frank ever used was a six-man crew.
Mm. Okay, you said you had a couple of other things. But
yes, we mentioned at the start of the program, you know, you mentioned that as you got more into the mob thing, questions were raised, and one of the first questions you asked was about the family and the structure. And I'll tell you what I think would be a great thing for any person researching or wanting to get more familiar with an organized crime family. And I did this myself because I said I need to learn a little bit about the structure. So what my recommendation is that you tell Jan that you're going to start running your family as an organized crime family. You're going to be the boss. She's going to be the underboss. And you want her to go out and earn. She can keep some of what she earns. She has to kick the rest up to you. And let me know how you make out with that.
I can't wait to break that good news to her.
On a serious note, I was surprised. I was talking to Andrew. We were talking about made men. And I belong to different groups and organizations throughout the years. And I know that a lot of them, you had an enrollment period when there were certain times they would accept new members. I didn't realize that the organized crime did the same thing with their made men, becoming a made man. They would, what they called, open the books. But Andrew was telling me that in some cases, due to law enforcement pressure, it might go a couple of years before the books would be opened. In other words, their open enrollment period, if you want to refer to it as that, wasn't continuous. And you might have to wait a couple of years, depending on the law enforcement situation, in order to have your name submitted to become a made man. So I don't know about you, but I was a little surprised by that. I thought that it was kind of a year-round thing. And you could be, have your name submitted and go through the process and the initiation and all that. But that isn't the way it worked. And that was something that, as Andrew was mentioning, this all-out war by law enforcement against the mob even impacted when people could become made and move up the ladder. So I thought that was a little bit surprising. I just been under the impression whenever the boss felt you qualified or had done whatever you needed to do to earn that position, that it was kind of a done deal right at the time, but that is not the way it works.
In fact, on the subject of made men, today's families seem to be very different. I hate to keep harping on this child prostitution thing, but I mean, it seems to me that the people of today are not quite the people of yesterday. What's your thoughts, Andrew? Are they recruiting in the wrong place?
No, it's not that. It's just that the gene pool changed. I mean, years ago we grew up differently. There was a lot more guys around at the time, so to speak. Let's put it this way: between mid-80s till the mid-90s, I think the influx of guys like me going to prison was just astronomical. I mean, the ranks just diminished. I mean, I could right now, if I talk about 10 friends of mine, maybe 3 or 4 of them are dead. The other 7 are doing time right now as we speak, and this is just 10. I can go with other crews and guys that I know throughout organized crime circles. Guys have been in jail now for 16, 17 years, 18 years. And it's like anything else. It's like, I don't want to quote the Bible here, but it becomes what they say, the meek shall inherit the earth. Well, the guys who really did nothing, who were just around, so to speak, guys who were just, hang around us, they're the ones who inherited this all now, because everybody else who was out there trying to make something happen, committing crimes, grunt workers, guys who are doing the meat and potatoes of organized crime activity, are all in jail. And these guys who are left over now, who are in the street, aren't qualified, Simon. They're just not qualified. I'm not saying they're not good guys in organized crime eyes. They might be really good eyes, but they're not seasoned. They're not ready. And I think what's happening here is, I mean, they have outright pedophiles here. 20 years ago, these guys couldn't even hold a conversation with us, let alone even be involved in the day-to-day activities of organized crime activity. It just wouldn't happen. It just wouldn't be. Maybe we'd shake them down. Maybe we'd say, listen, you want to be a fucking pimp? You be a pimp. But you pay us so much a week, or we put you in the trunk of a car. You got 2 choices. That's it. And you make life so unreasonable and so uncomfortable for this guy that he just packs up shop and moves on. But today, they're ingratiating this guy, and they're giving him a leg up and a platform to do his business. And to me, that just goes to show you that the gene pool has changed. And it's like anything else. I mean, after a while, you start to, it's like, digging dirt out of a hole. After a while, you get too deep at the bottom. You got nothing but shit at the bottom now. And that's what happens. Same with organized crime. And yeah, it's affected it really, really bad. And the structure's changed also, because I'll tell you what, say, let me give you a hypothetical. Say I wasn't a government witness, and I finished up my time, and I went back on the street or whatever. I know, and I could tell you wholeheartedly, there's no way in the world that I would trust the guys even in the highest position of the family. What I would do is I would continue to rob and steal and earn with the guys I grew up with, the guys that I know I could trust. And I would never give that privy information to a boss or a captain, whoever it may be, because I can't trust him no more. Because he could hurt me just like the guy in the trenches with me could hurt me. So that's what you're going to see. You're going to see a lot of splinter cells, so to speak. Guys just going out there and handling their business with the guys who they're comfortable with. And they're going to leave everybody else and their privy information to themselves. That's how it's going to be. There's no more trust anymore. I spoke to our friend Joe last week. We were talking about it. And Joe became a witness a few years after I did. And me and Joe were dear friends. Our friendship goes back to the early 80s. And he told me, he says, you have no idea, he said, when, you know, you were incarcerated and we were still on the street, he says, it was amazing to see how there was no more trust. Guys were talking to each other, and now it just became cutthroat. There was no more unity. There was no more family. Everything was cutthroat. Everybody robbing from one another. Everybody distrust. Because what happened is it started to deteriorate. And guys see it for what it is, and they realize that the guy in the upper positions weren't the heroes that we thought they were, Simon. They were just greedy, selfish individuals who ran guys like me into the ground until we had no more to give. And this is what you have now. Now you have shit on the street, and whatever's left in the power positions, you know, partake a few other guys who are, you know, old school guys who are qualified. There's nobody left. There's really nobody left. And now you're just going to have a splinter cell of street gangs who carry themselves with organized crime values to a certain extent. But for the most part, the structure as we know it traditional is dead in the water.
I mean, you mentioned street gang, and that's what I'm beginning to view it as. It seems to me that a lot of the values, and you know, this may sound like a very odd thing to say, but you know, a lot of the values have been lost. Enormous amount of, you know, murders were committed, but generally speaking, organized crime people didn't go out and, randomly shoot innocent people.
No, they did not. And not only that, sir, I mean, you hit it right on the head. I mean, as far as gang activity and stuff like that, I'll give you a disciplinary action. I'll show you something. 20-something years ago, you know, you were part of a crew, you went to jail, they looked out for your family, or you would hope they did. They would send your wife a few dollars. They were looking on your family every now and then. Now you go to jail. Your wife is in the street. You've got guys from your crew looking to fuck your wife. I mean, it's just ridiculous. There's no more unity. It's like it became a very self-preservation, selfish existence. And it's terrible to say. It really is. It's terrible to say. You know, because I grew up with these values in my head, and I thought that I was a part of something that was great. I thought I was part of a great entity, that I was part of something that other people around me were missing the boat. And I pretty much felt bad for other people. I thought that, hey, I'm part of something really, really good here. But in the end of the day, after I started to get my lumps and bumps through the years, I realized I was sold a bill of goods like the next man, that it wasn't what I thought it was. And it was heartbreaking, you know, because, you know, you grow up. I was telling Dennis this the other day. You grow up, and there's guys in the street who are mob legends. And I was incarcerated with these guys. And after you're incarcerated with these guys, it's such a letdown because half of them are a shell of what they were, had a reputation for in the street. To see them incarcerated was almost sad. I was like, this guy was a legend in the street. In prison, this guy is like a, I can't even begin to even choose a word. But it was such a letdown. And I think that in some instances, the way that everybody put, glorified this life, they glorified it to the extent where it got distorted. It really got distorted. And at the end of the day, it's a bunch of criminals who are trying to keep out of harm's way from law enforcement, who there are no friendships. Me and you could have been friends for 30 years, Simon. The minute we entered organized crime circles, that friendship is never the same. Because there's going to come a day where our superiors aren't going to like what you're doing or not going to like what I'm doing. And who are they going to choose to come after you? They're going to choose the guy you trust most. So that friendship is pretty much out the window. And it's sad. It really is sad. You know, because at 2 o'clock in the morning, if you need somebody, you're going to call me. You're not going to call the boss. But then, so you can get a leg up in this life, if the boss tells you I got to go, you're going to kill me. Because number one, you're afraid that if you don't, he's going to kill you as well. And we're pawns. We're pawns. And the more you think about it, the sadder it is. Because even myself, I didn't see this. But at the end of the day, you realize you didn't make that one solid decision in your life when you evolved with these people on your own. Every decision you made reverted back to, what are they going to think if I do A, B, C, or D? You know,
right.
So it's very eye-opening. I think that people need to really, really see it for what it is. And you can't expect people to understand this in one radio show or understand this for whatever, because there's always going to be people out there who, you know, this guy's just a rat. There's no sour grapes here. There's no sour grapes by my standards. I'm happy with the decision I made. I made a conscious decision to take my life back, okay? Because I seen it for what it was. I gave my life to these people. I walked through a fire for these people. I went out in the street with a gun in my hand and pulled the trigger numerous times for these people. Do you think at the end of the day when you wake up and you realize that, hey, this guy don't care if I live, die, or indifferent. Now I got to protect him knowing that he wants to kill me? These are the things that you're faced with at the end of the day. And you get these, how do I call them? Monday morning quarterbacks who sit in their house and they watch The Sopranos and they watch The Godfather and think they know about the mom. It's almost laughable.
It is. I mean, as I said in my introduction, you know, I knew virtually nothing about the mob until I met Denny Griffin. You know, all I knew was what I saw on the TV, and it's just not like that.
Not at all. And you know when you hit a nerve, Simon, you hit a nerve when you get people saying, he's a fucking liar. He's a liar. Of course, because that's the only weapon they have. The only thing they could say is call you a liar. Because at the end of the day, there's one thing that organized crime can't stand being in a room with, Simon. That's the fucking truth.
Mm.
If organized crime is in the room with the truth, organized crime can't breathe. Because from the minute we were raised in this life, you were raised to lie, scheme on everybody outside that door. And the day that you bring forward the truth, these guys start to suffocate. So it's rat, liar, this, that. And the more they call you that, the more you know you're scratching the truth. And that's what people need to see. Because, you know, I didn't wake up one morning and decide to turn my back on my friends. I think I told you this once before. You don't just wake up and become the thing you were raised to hate your whole life. You become that when you realize that the life you've been living, that's been the lie. You feel betrayed. Because you thought you were honorable in what you were doing, justified in your actions. And at the end of the day, you're not. You're a pawn, a very small pimple on a very big ass. And that's the way it is.
Denny, I know that you spent many years as an investigator, but not in the criminal aspect so much. So I believe it was medical or something like that.
It was for white collar crime, fraud,
okay.
Healthcare fraud.
I mean, when you first started delving into the mob, which you seem to have now made a career out of. I mean, how shocked were you? You know, how different was, you know, your perception once you started to investigate, as opposed to, you know, your perception just as a man in the street?
I was very shocked, might be the right word, surprised. When I started when I started researching for my books and began to talk to the organized crime investigators, be it state or federal, local, and talk to the guys who had actually done the work and the strategies and how they were developed and what, you know, trying to stay within the legal guidelines and but yet knowing your opponent, the organized crime people, really had no guidelines from the legal standpoint. And then when I had access to Frank Collada and in turn now since then, others such as Andrew and some of their former colleagues, hearing from the mob side what they were thinking, what they did, why they did it. It's opened up a whole new world for me. And it's maybe initially it was shocking, but now that I've developed an understanding of both sides, it's no longer shocking because I understand now why certain things were done, why they had to be done in a certain way. But for me, it's just intriguing because that the whole lifestyle that these mob people or former mob people live is so alien to what most of us experience.
And indeed. I mean,
it's fascinating.
You know, I received a phone call from Andrew or an email from him a couple of weeks ago, you know, that just said, oh, that phone number doesn't work anymore. I've moved locations. You're right.
Yeah, and what we think is, you know, would surprise us to say, no, man, nobody lives like that. I mean, to these people, it's the way of life. I mean, that's the way it is. There's nothing weird about it. That's how they have to or had to exist when they were in the life or since they've gotten out of it. So it's, like I say, for someone like me who is interested in investigations and in crime, organized crime, the new world I've had opened for me is just absolutely fascinating, and I'm having some of the best times in my life from the point of interest of being able to get both sides of the story. And it's really something I wouldn't trade. It's been a great experience, and working with Frank was, working with Andrew is, and some of the other people I've met. You know, and I was just thinking while you and Andrew were chatting here a minute ago, we're talking about organized crime today versus what it was. Since I got involved in writing true crime, I've covered pretty much 50 or 60 years. And for example, I've met and have worked with the former underboss of Mickey Cohen's in the Los Angeles mob. He was back in the 50s and 60s. Frank Collada's main activity was from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I've spent time, I don't mean in the jail sense, but spent some hours with Henry Hill. I've never written a book with him, but of course he was, he turned in, I think it was 80 or 81, just about when Andrew was becoming involved with the Gambinos. So my different contacts I've made over the last few years, it's given me a history of different families and different time frames in the organized crime history from the 50s all the way up to virtually to today. So it's been a very educational experience.
You're an author and crime writer. I guess loosely I could be termed as a kind of journalist. Do you ever worry that we may be poking around into areas that should be best left alone? And the reason I ask that is something my wife Jan said the other day. She said, oh, you're going to get us all killed.
Well, I've got to say that when I first started this, I did think about that some, and my wife more so than me. She was not particularly happy when I got into the true crime arena. But, you know, the people that I associate with or work with, have contact with, they know pretty much, Andrew, for example, and Frank. You know, they know their own vulnerabilities. They know their own risk factors. I don't ask them for anything that I think, first of all, that would place them in an awkward situation. We have an agreement that we're going to tell the truth and we're going to be factual. But I don't try to stick my nose in to things where I don't think my nose belongs. And I think that's a good thing. A lot of the stuff that I write about is stuff that's public information, but it's the inside story of it. Okay, in other words, I'm not trying to solve cold case organized crime hits, for example. So my thought is that I trust the people I'm working with and their judgment as to where we can go, or if there's a place we can't go, they would know that. And, you know, I have my instincts over the years have always been pretty good. So, yeah, I guess maybe that there's some remote possibility sometime I could step on somebody's toes, or you could, or any of us could. But it's nothing I lose any sleep over. And, you know, I try to use good judgment, and I try to work with people whose judgment I respect, and that they're not going to do anything that's going to put me in the soup.
Okay, and I think it's time for one of those shameless commercial breaks. Denny,
yes.
You are premiering a program on Tuesday. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, as a matter of fact, I do. Yes, it's called Crime Wire, and it's the main impetus for this program is the number of people who are out there, primarily families of victims who have been killed, and in cases that are either cold case unsolved, current unsolved, or probably the most frustrating of the lot are the cases in which the initial investigations by the authorities, it could be a fire department, it could be a medical examiner, a coroner's office, it could be a police agency, may have not been up to speed. And what cases that may have been homicides were determined to be accidents or suicides. And families have been battling the system for, in some cases, years, trying to get a death certificate changed, trying to get an investigation launched, actually, for the initial launch, because nothing was done at the time of the death, or get a case reopened or the investigation reopened or reinvigorated. And what we're going to do is profile some of these cases that did not get the attention, perhaps, from the authorities or from the media that they should have gotten. And we're going to take a closer look at those cases and see if we can't help the families of the victims get some justice or some closure to their cases. And initially, we're having a two-pronged approach. We're going to be doing a blog talk radio show weekly, and our debut show is next Tuesday, the 1st, at 9 p.m. Eastern. And we also have a website, and we're going to be profiling some of those cases on the website. So I'm very excited about it. I think I think people will be surprised at the number of these cases that are out there. It's just, I'm former law enforcement. I'm very pro-law enforcement. But I also realize that when you're dealing with many different agencies, a lot of the bureaucracy in the, not just the police agencies, but other governmental agencies, there are going to be times where things maybe aren't done exactly as they should have been done. And
Who are your co-conspirators?
Well, I'm involved with private investigator, former Stamford, Connecticut cop Vito Colucci Jr., and domestic violence expert Susan Murphy Milano. and the three of us are co-hosts, and we have some what I think are very excellent consultants. And if you've ever heard of Mickey Sherman, the criminal defense attorney, who is frequently on various cable news networks as a legal analyst. His wife, Lise Wheel, is a Fox News Channel legal analyst and former prosecutor. Donna Pendergast is an attorney general from Michigan, the assistant deputy attorney general from Michigan, and she has one of the highest murder conviction rates in the country. And we have Albuquerque, New Mexico, private investigator Pat Caristo, who's going to be one of our analysts and consultants. And also from Syracuse, New York, Bill Sullivan, who runs Forensic Consulting Specialties, and he's a forensic investigator. So we have a pretty good team we're putting together, and I would be terrible if I didn't mention Peter Hyatt, who's a statement analyst and is a frequent panelist on your Sunday afternoon shows. And Peter is also joining us. So I think we got a pretty high-octane team here, and we hope to be able to do some good and help get some cases reinvigorated and maybe bring some closure to some of these families.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it, Denny. I think you have a great idea. And Andrew, we've got to do some shameless advertising for you.
Well, as far as advertising for me as well, I'm involved with Dennis as well on the CrimeWire team. I'm helping producing that. For me, it's a win-win. It gives me an opportunity and a chance to give back for all the years of the wrongs that I've done. Of course, I can't correct those, but I could do something now with my time to help others, which I'm trying to do. So CrimeWire is a very, very great subject and project for me. I think it's great content. It gives really, really closure to some families, gives other families hope. And I think that that's what people need to see. They need to see some success stories, because there are some success stories out there. And I'm doing that as well with Dennis. I'm also, me and Dennis are in the process of writing my book, Surviving the Mob. It'll be out this coming fall. I just completed a DVD called Surviving the Mob in the same name. That's already on Amazon.com. I did these projects to open the people's eyes on organized crime, like what we're talking about today, to let them see that there are no happy endings. For some reason, people think that if you become a government witness, you get whisked away and it's a happy ending or whatever, but they fail to realize that in this life, there's three ways to get out of it in organized crime. You either rot in a jail cell for the rest of your life, you get found with a gun in your hand with two bullets in your head in the street, or you go on the run for the rest of your life. And me, I became a government witness. Either way, your family suffers. And I think it was an important aspect for me to do these projects to open people's eyes and maybe touch some high-risk youths who are out there, kids who are out there who think that, you know, gang activity or organized crime activity is the way to go. Because I think there's like a 1% of guys in my life who actually reap the rewards of their crimes and who get to dance at their children's weddings and watch their grandchildren grow up. And I think that people need to see those statistics so they know that there's a no-win scenario here. You know, of course, yeah, you make a lot of money through your life and all that glamour that people did come along with it. It's a brutal, brutal existence. And, you know, if you have one good day, you have 10 bad days to match that one good day. And I think that, you know, that's what I'm trying to do with my project. And me and Dennis are really hitting a home run here. We're on the right page. And the book is coming along tremendously, Simon. Pretty soon we're going to look at you to do some proofreading of our manuscript, because it's going in real soon. And hopefully we'll get the word out there. And I think if people want to see just a little bit of emotion and to see what this life does to people, how it ruins everybody and the families that are affected by it, they need to watch the DVD right now, because the DVD will open their eyes, you know.
I'll put in a plug for this DVD. I was sent an early unedited version, and I was glued. I mean, it was the most brutal thing I think I've ever watched, and it was clear that you were very, very emotional over some parts of it. I mean,
Of course, I was very, I was, you know, I opened up a lot of old wounds with it, Simon. You know, you reach back in time, you start talking about things you were involved in, and I look back on my life, and I said this so many times because there's no other really way to describe it. I look at my life, and I look back, and it's like a runaway train, and I see all the devastation and damage I did over the years, and you can't get that back. You can't, you know, so the best thing to do is let people see. Maybe somebody could learn from that. And I'm not going to change the world or what I do, but at least I can give a positive message to somebody who may think this is the way to go. I lost everything from this life. You know, I lost relationships with family. I got taken away to live in parts unknown where I won't pick these places on my best day. And, you know, you sit here and you realize and you count the losses. Of course, I'm grateful to be alive because I'm lucky to be alive, so I make the best of my life now. But the pain that I caused my own family and, you know, being estranged from my son and everything like that, it's devastating. It really is devastating.
I don't think I want to pry. I didn't realize you had a son, but I take it that you, you're estranged from him.
I'm estranged from my son. It's been a number of years since I've seen my son. You have to understand something, Simon. In the area where I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, organized crime is in the fabric of society there, okay? And I'll give you the mindset of the area. In my area, it is accepted behavior to kill your best friend if you have to. But don't you ever fucking tell on him.
Oh.
Do you see how misconstrued the thinking is in that area?
Oh,
and what happened is that I was divorced from my wife, and I became a government witness, and I went about my life, and I didn't leave them behind. They had the opportunity to get relocated if they wanted to and everything else like that. And being that we were divorced already, it's not something that my ex-wife wanted to do. And she developed a lot of friendships with the people that I was bothering with throughout the years, with their wives or sisters or families or whatever. And she decided to stay there. And being she decided to do that, it put a very big strain on me ever trying to have a relationship with my son. And until this day, it's a work in progress. And until this day, I like to leave the door open for him. And he's a stranger to me, and I'm a stranger to him. And it's sad because it doesn't have to be that way. But there is so much pressure on their end that I could understand it. And so even though I'm a free man, organized crime has found its way to prevent me from being a father to my son. Because now, you know, and I don't blame them at all. I chose my decisions in life. I was taken away from my son at a very early age, and I spent a lot of years in prison. You know, and I missed the first 6 years of his life. I was home for 30 months, 17 months of him on the run, went back to jail for another 4.5 years. So I missed so much a part of this child's life. I take responsibility for that. But there's other people who are responsible for where that situation is today. So, but I'll never give up. And I, you know, as a parent, you can't. But that's basically my son's decision to make. And he's a man now. So hopefully he'll see through all of that shit that he's surrounded with. And he'll see that the decisions that I made were hard-pressed decisions to make. But I did them all, ironically, Simon. I did them thinking I was going to be able to be a dad for him now. And unfortunately, it wasn't in the cards for me.
How old is he, just out of curiosity?
He's going to be 23 years old. And, you know, I missed so many years. I haven't seen him physically in almost 9 years. I was away for the first 6 years of his life. I was away again for another 4 years after that. So I missed most of this child's life. And I can't get that back. And, it's from my life choices. I wanted to be a criminal. And I was an organized crime member. And if you're in organized crime circles, organized crime comes first. Your family comes second. And then once you realize, when you make a change in your life, how warped your thinking was, or your thinking process, you realize that, hey, you know, too little, too late, pal. You dug this grave for yourself. And But I try every day to get that. I try every day. I try to task by going out there and trying to help other kids who might be it. I try it by putting the DVD out to open the eyes of people who may think that they're heroes out there. There's no heroes in organized crime. These guys are, you know, I was part of it. You know, you're the brutality on society. We were there to suck society dry. So at the end of the day, when they want to romanticize it, please, it makes me laugh. You know, it's not what people think. You know, people have no idea. I'm not even scratching the surface here today. You know, I'm not even scratching the surface, Simon.
Denny, I've got a sexist question for you.
Okay.
All right. You know, I mentioned before that I'm no expert on organized crime, but I can't think of a single woman that was an active part. I mean, sure, there were wives and girlfriends, but were there any foot soldiers in any of the families that were female?
Now that you mentioned, Simon, I'm just trying to think here. I can't think of any that I'm aware of. I don't say there aren't any, but if there are, I'm not aware of them. I guess at the minimum, I'd have to say they were probably rare. You're right, girlfriends and wives, that type of thing, but as far as active soldiers, I'm not familiar. Or maybe Andrew can help us out with that.
Yeah, Andrew?
Well, to be honest with you, Simon, what we call girls from the neighborhood who are, you know, what we might call stand-up broads or knock-around broads. And what happens is these women or girlfriends, whoever they may be, you know, they're not privy to what you're doing, but they pretty much know the life in itself. They know what you're doing. You know, it's not like they're stupid that they think you work construction or you own some business. They know you're a criminal. And they're bouncing around with you, and they're, you know, they're living with you and having a palm with you or whatever, and they're reaping the rewards of the things that you're stealing or whatever else you're doing or the drugs you're selling, and they're doing this and that. But there's in Italy it's a little different. In Italy there have been women who have pretty much ran the day-to-day activities in, you know, certain towns in Italy where their husbands were bosses. And these women took over the operations or whatever it may be. In Italy, it's a lot different. In the United States, we just call them knock-around broads that, you know, they'll stand up, they'll hide drugs for you if you're going to get arrested. They'll be part of a scheme. You know, they'll go in there and they'll commit crimes, but they're not made members of the family. They're just associates and people that we could go to. Or woman might work in a boutique. I walk in. I got a phony credit card. I walk in. She's one of my people. You know, she's down whatever it is, scam or scheme that I'm involved in, check scam, whatever it may be. And like that, she's a criminal, but she's not an organized crime figure. You know, it's a little bit different. If, you know, throughout the years, I'm sure there was some women that, you know, that I didn't know about who were a little bit more in the know than what I'm explaining. But for the most part, from my own experience, that was the experience that I had.
Well, one of the things that I've been reading about recently is the Russian mafia and the Chinese mafia. Do they really feature in the game these days?
Of course, Russian organized crime is very, very big. As a matter of fact, when I just got my last arrest, when I was on the run, I got arrested in Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn, and in Manhattan Beach, right, you know, not too far away, is Brighton Beach. And it's a very tremendous Russian area. A lot of Russian immigrants live in that area. And I met numerous Russian organized crime figures when I was on the street. I did business with a few guys here or there, nothing too major. But when I was away in prison, I happened to, you know, be in the same facility as Russian organized crime figures and guys who were doing really stuff. And they are. They're full force. They're out there. You know, their crimes are a little bit different because, you know, they're from Europe and they're doing stuff in Europe. And, of course, it comes back here. And but, you know, it's basic like everything else. There's drug dealers who are Russian and there's, you know, they're part of scams and Wall Street stuff and, you know, embezzlement of businesses and money like that and cyber crimes. And it's like anything else, you know, but they're there. They are there. And throughout my life, I've been involved with a few of them. And for the most part, they're just like Italian organized crime members. They're just trying to stay one step ahead of law enforcement, and they're trying to put money in their pocket, and pretty much they trust their own, and they're very leery of people outside of their inner circle. And, Chinese mafia guys, I was away with a lot of gang members. I was away with a lot of Chinese gang members, you know, from Manhattan, Chinatown, and everything like that. And they were very big in the extortion game, drug dealing. I happened to be away with one kid who was a captain of one of those human trafficking boats from China. He came here, crashed on a beach in Rockaways, New York, and he got exposed. Some people died in the voyage, and I was away with him for a number of years. And you learn all of these different things about people. And as long as there's money to be made anywhere in the world, there'll be crime. And it doesn't even have to be organized crime. There'll be crime. As long as there's a big flow of cash, there'll be crime.
Denny, I'm gonna put you on the hot seat here.
Uh-oh.
What defines organized crime?
Well, you can... when I hear the term, I just generally tend to think of the Italian mafia, the American, Italian-American mafia. That always is what comes into my mind with organized crime and perhaps, you know, from the Godfather movies and so forth, but that's what I think of. Certainly, it's more than that. It's when you have an organization, I guess is the best way to call it, organized crime, and you have a hierarchy and so forth, as opposed to an individual just going out knocking over convenience stores or something. Now, he's obviously, or she is obviously, a criminal, but they don't have the organization. And I think these biker gangs, for example, can be organized, and they have a pecking order and so forth. And you can have those. They can be different. They can be the, as you were talking, the Russians, the Chinese, the Vietnamese, gangs or organizations that are organized versus the individual or two-man, if you will, or whatever, people that go out with no organization but just committing crime. So the key word, I guess, is organized.
Organized. Okay. A favorite Hollywood aspect of organized crime is gambling. And there's, in my mind anyway, two sides to that coin. Vegas was famous for skimming. Denny, you know lots about that. Not that you ever did it. I wasn't trying to wasn't trying to implicate you in any shape or form. What are the other aspects of gambling that organized crime is are involved in?
That's
a number of things. Who's the question for, Simon?
Andrew, you're the expert.
Well, basically, the bottom line is you have to understand this. If there's a sporting event in the country going on anywhere, organized crime is putting it out there for somebody to bet. I myself ran what we call a horse room back in the late 80s for the Gambino family. I operated day-to-day. I had a satellite on the roof. We showed major horse racing events around the country. I think we showed like 5 or 6 different racetracks a day. I took bets for baseball, football, hockey, basketball, soccer, the whole bit. We took daily numbers, the daily lottery numbers. And we were all access for people in the neighborhood who didn't want to travel to a racetrack. We gave track guards for most of the bets. And for the regular, like I say, your regular day-to-day betting on baseball or football, whatever, we took those bets every day. And as far as that's concerned. When I was a little younger, in the early 80s, our crew was involved in a lot of crap games, so to speak. And when I started to get involved, it was a little, not as much anymore, but they used to have crap games in Manhattan, and, you know, and they would have what they call roving games. Each week the game would be in a different location so they wouldn't get arrested. And these were big money games. You know, I think, whatever it may be, a $200 limits on a bet. Some of them in bigger games were like $400 or $500. The house would, you know, take care of all the bets. And it was ran like any other business. They had a Shylock on premises to loan people money if they needed money. honestly, it was really ran like a legitimate business. And same thing with the horse room. It was ran like a legitimate business. At the end of the day, we took in, we had what we call ins, outs, expenses. We seen how much money we took in, how much money we paid out, how much money we started with, how much money we finished up with. That was our figure at the end of the day. And then we had to figure out how much running the operation costs, rent of the building, paying workers, everything else. It's run like a business. Fortunately, I was in a very good spot. I lasted a very long time there, never got arrested. I was also pretty lucky where I had never had a losing week. And I made a lot of money for the family doing that. And I learned a lot. Because if anybody knows, horse bettors are a different breed of people altogether. And, you know, it was a learning experience for me. It really was. But I enjoyed it. I really did. I enjoyed it. I met they were just regular people from the neighborhood, working stiffs and, you know, people who worked for a living. They weren't criminals. But they came there and they had a vice, which was gambling. And we were there to accommodate. And that's what organized crime does. It accommodates vices.
Okay, so you weren't fiddling with the odds. You were giving
we
them.
We fiddle with the odds. We fiddle with the odds. It's like anything else. It's like if you're in Las Vegas and you look at the board and you see, say we're betting on the Jets, the New York Jets. The New York Jets might be -3. They're -3, -3, -3. But then the house sees that too many people are betting the Jets. What they might do is change the odds so people stop betting the other side. What we do in organized crime circles is we change the odds and then what we call edge off. If I see I'm getting too much business on everybody betting the same event, the same team, what I'll do is I'll edge my bets off to other bookmakers so that when I do take the bets, I don't get hurt financially. And the other bookmakers absorb that loss as well. And other times we change the odds so people stop betting the other way. So you get a little, you even out the playing field, so to speak. Because as a bookmaker, I make my money with the VIG. So I make my money where the winners and losers, I make my money regardless. It doesn't matter if I win or lose the bet. Because what I do is I space out the bets so much that I keep it an even keel. And I just keep the VIG money. And that's how I earn. And we moved the odds around. I think for the races, what we did was, not to get hurt by trifectas and all these exotic bets that people can make, we put limits on trifectas and all other exotic bets. We didn't give track odds as far as that was concerned. We gave track odds on win, play, show, you know, some other stuff. But for the most part, the exotic bets, we pretty much put a limit on so we couldn't get hurt. And whenever you put a limit on any sporting event or anything, Simon, you put yourself in a position to always be in the advantage. So the house never loses. It never loses.
Right. Denny, I believe it's in the Battle for Las Vegas. You tell a story about the world's greatest odds maker.
Lefty Rosenthal?
Yes.
Yes. Lefty Rosenthal. One of the best, if not the best, I guess, that ever lived.
Right. Now, he was a mob member, wasn't he?
Well, he was an associate because being Jewish, he didn't qualify to become a made man. So he had to assume the role of an associate.
Right. And
he worked with them and made them a lot of money.
Yeah, and his mission in life was basically to set the odds on anything people wanted to bet on.
Exactly. Yep. He would... a master odds maker, as he was referred to. And, you know, I just wanted to mention something when you and Andrew were talking. you're talking about betting the horses and, of course, the lotteries and so forth. When Andrew and I were working on the section for his book about illegal gambling and mob-controlled gaming, we got talking and about how sometimes they say colleges for football, for example, are like the training grounds for the pros. They recruit and get these college kids who show promise. Well, it seems like in a lot of cases, the governments, be it state or federal, would keep an eye on what the mob was successful doing. And in New York, for example, the mob was making a lot of money on horse betting, and lo and behold, New York ends up with an off-track betting operation, off-track betting parlors. The numbers rackets, or numbers games, if you will, making all kinds of money for organized crime, and all of a sudden all the states start coming up with state lotteries. So to some degree, it looks like maybe the government kept an eye on what the mob was making big money on, and it looked so lucrative, they ended up getting in the same business themselves.
So I've heard the term numbers game. So the numbers game literally was a lottery.
Yes, it was a lottery, Simon. It was a lottery. The numbers game is, you got to understand something. It's probably a very, that's why the government took it over with state-run lotteries, because it's such a lucrative business. And people don't realize that, you know, it's, I can't explain it, the revenue that you can make with running a daily number. It's astronomical, because I think the odds of somebody hitting the number are like, I don't know, it's ridiculous. You know, it happens. I hit the number a few times in my life, you know, and this, that, the other thing. But for the most part, the way we used to run it was we would pay 500 to 1. So every dollar you bet, if your number came out straight, for every dollar you bet, you get 500 back. And I think the Brooklyn number, I think we used to have a Brooklyn number and a New York number. One number was designated from the 3rd, 5th, and 7th race of whatever racetrack was designated. The other number was what you would call the total mutual handle of the day, the money's taken in, or whatever the case may be. It was the last 3 digits of the money's taken in, and that's how they distinguished what the number was of the day. And when the lottery took it over, they even paid their runners less money. Like the guy in the lottery, the guy at the newsstand who has the machine, I think he was only getting like 6%. Where in the mob, the controller was getting 35% from the boss. He would get 35% from the boss, give 25% to his runner, and he'd keep 10% for himself. And the state lottery was only paying out 6%. So think of how much money they were making. So, and they had the balls to say when they first started it that they weren't making any money. And not only that, if too much action got played on a number in the state lottery, they could shut the number down. In other words, if me and you like the number 711, so to speak, they could take so much action on the number 711 and then shut the customer out. In organized crime, you can't shut a customer out. So what we got to do is we go and we edge off that number to other people if we got too much action on it. But the state lottery just shuts you down. So when they say they didn't make that much money, they, Simon, when I tell you so full of shit you can't even imagine. Because the odds are in their favor, and they're only paying out 6% to the controller. Even organized crime was paying 3 times that amount.
Now that genuinely is funny. We're almost out of time. I do want to throw in a question just for shits and grins. Do either of you know where Jimmy Hoffa is?
Where Jimmy Hoffa is? Let me tell you something. Whoever knows that answer, I tell them, I say to myself, you know what? It's one of those things, Simon, that nobody's ever going to know. And not at this stage. Too much time has passed. Probably everybody who had anything to do with it is dead. And, you know, everything you're going to get now is just a chatter in the background, third-party news or whatever the case may be. And, you know, some mountains are made to be admired, some to be climbed. That one you just admire and just let it go. It's over with. You know, may him rest in peace. May his family be able to, you know, you know, have peace in some fashion. I know it's got to be devastating to not be able to find a loved one. This is what we're doing with Crime Wire. We're trying to help people along the way who may have lost a loved one. And I have another dear friend of mine who was an organized crime figure who had lost a family member of his, and he was nice enough to bring that case to fruition for us to put on Crime Wire. And I'm looking forward to that scenario to come out so people can see that, you know, sometimes, you know, the cases do get solved. And for the most part, you know, it's a good thing. That show is going to be a good thing. And I want to thank you guys for taking out the time today to spend with me. Simon, you're always a gentleman. I tell you, you know, I enjoy your radio shows very much. And I'll come on anytime you ask. It's a pleasure.
It has been my pleasure to host this program today. And I really want to thank Andrew DiDonato for taking time out to talk with us. I've certainly learned a lot. And I also want to thank my good friend, Denny Griffin. Denny, you always bring a new dimension to whatever it is we're talking about.
Well, good. I'm glad I do, Simon.
So, until next time, this is Simon Barrett for Blogger News on the radio, wishing everyone a very happy Memorial Day, and thank you once again to my guests. Have a
great day, Simon.
Yeah.
Thanks,
you
Simon.
Too, you and your family. Have a nice weekend.
Bye. We will. Okay. Goodbye.